I present to you the Honorable Walter H. Judd.
Thank you very much. I'm always glad to get that at the beginning because I generally don't at the end. Now, I'm kind of embarrassed by all the nice things Carl said. Probably you know him well enough so you don't take it too seriously. I heard of a fellow who was in the dentist chair, and he said to the dentist, "What makes that little tiny cavity seem so big?" And the dentist said, "I don't know, unless it must be the normal tendency of the tongue to exaggerate." But Carl and I have worked together since we were student days, and I don't know anybody whose kind word I would appreciate personally more than his saying these things today. And so you can understand when he called up and sort of twisted my arm to come, there wasn't anything else I could do, was there? I was a little like Adam when Eve is supposed to have said to him, "Adam, dear, do you really love me?" And he said, "Who else?" But I'm in a different role from some of those that he spoke about. He gave all these big, "I'm not here today as a..." And again, you exaggerated. I wasn't given such an honor for the whole government. It was just the House of Representatives, a little smaller group. But you heard about that. I'm sure the lady was taking her first plane ride, and she was a little apprehensive, as almost everybody is on that first occasion. As luck would have it, they got into a violent storm. The plane just tossed around. She got panicky, and she turned to a clergyman sitting next to her, and she said, "Father, you're a man of God. Can't you do something about this?" He said, "Lady, I'm in sales, not management." I'm here today not in management, I'm in sales. And it's always, believe me, a pleasure to have a privilege to have a chance to talk to a group of men like you who... haven't come here to argue whether or not you should be Christians. You've accepted Jesus Christ at least once, or you wouldn't be here probably. Once almost never is once enough, and I find that they have to have them every once in a while. I don't eat just once a week or once a month. I have to eat food a little more often than that if I'm to have growth and health in my physical body. Your commitment to Christ has been made. You aren't here to ask, as I say, whether, but how can I be more effective? That's what you want to do, isn't it? That's what I want to do. How can I be more effective in my witness to Jesus Christ, whom I have accepted as my Lord, my Master, my Guide, my Counselor, my Teacher, and all these other roles? Now, you've chosen as your subject for this... your theme for this conference for such a time as this, and I'm glad that. And that's one reason I felt maybe I could make some contribution, because I've been in the midst of the situations which led to the times in which we find ourselves. I don't believe there's ever been a time in our country's history characterized by a greater mixture of emotions than is the case today. On one hand, never did anybody have so much to be grateful for as we have. And I think never has any people, when it stops to think about it, been more profoundly thankful for the goodness of living that's possible for us here. We've got problems, but look at the advantages. We're free. You didn't have to come to this meeting. Nobody ordered you here. But nobody could stand out there and forbid your coming. What wouldn't the people of Czechoslovakia give today? Or one-third of all God's children on this planet, for the opportunity to make that kind of a simple choice. Live in West Berlin or instead of East Berlin. Do or go where you wish. Buy or sell. Change your job. All kinds of things of that sort. We've got food to eat. We don't know what to do with the surpluses which our rich soil and the skills of our agricultural population enable them to produce. Our problem is how to get it distributed more equitably. Millions of people don't have enough, not because they haven't got to distribute equity, they just don't have enough. They don't have enough land. Where are they going to get enough land? It never rains enough in their part of the world. Maybe we can change the weather so as to get more rain and so on. Yet, despite all the good things that are possible for us here, I don't think there's been a time, at least in my experience, characterized by greater uneasiness, uncertainty, perplexity, dismay, even anxiety. Half the patients that come into our office, our offices, are struggling with some sort of anxiety. They've got a troublesome neurodermatitis or an arthritis or ulcer pains or vague chest pains or insomnia, but they got something else bothering them too. Maybe they got a boy in Vietnam, or they're worried about nuclear war, or they see the value of their life savings going down, going down. They worked hard, they saved, and my profession keeps them alive on the average 21 years longer than they could plan on having at the beginning of this century. I wish we could have those 21 years in between, say, 21 and 65. But like you, Carl, there's only one place we can put them over at the end. That's the only place you can put them. What am I going to do all those extra years to keep alert physically and alive mentally and spiritually when I see my own government refusing to manage its affairs responsibly and allows the value of my life savings to go down already to less than 50% of the purchasing power I had a right to expect? What am I going to do? Feed myself. I can't go to work. My government penalizes me after 65 for the industry which has been my virtue up until 65. Refuses to let me receive the benefits that I paid in for 20 or 30, 40 years. We know all why. Spread the employment around. But these are the anxieties, some of them. If I had two words to describe the world in which we live, time like this, the words I would pick out are conflicts and confusion. There have always been conflicts at home and abroad, but they're different and they're worse than we've had before. I'm going to talk this afternoon about some of those in the international world. Because if we aren't safe here, safe in the world, we can't carry on all the reforms. It won't do any good to have all these wonderful advances we work for if we aren't around. You got to be safe and you got to be sound. And you got to be sound if you're going to be safe, and you got to be safe if you'll be able to do the things that'll make our society sounder. I want to talk about the first safe this afternoon and discuss the other one tonight. Although they overlap, of course, all the time. This is the first time in all of man's history, I think, when all peoples, all continents, all cultures have been in dislocation, turmoil, unrest, even revolution. In the last 25 years, 1 billion people have gotten their independence. We started this process 25 years ago, July 4th, 1946, in Manila. We pulled down the American flag and ran up the Filipino flag. No riots, no bloodshed, no demonstrations, parades, protests. This is what we wanted to do. This was in accordance with our own national history. This is what we promised them we'd do. And so we pulled it down, gave them their independence. This started a process which, of course, was irreversible and irresistible. And in these 25 years and 2 months, 1 billion people have gotten their independence out of the disintegration of the old colonial system, mostly run from Western Europe, which had given the world such order as it had for several hundred years. Now, here are all these newly independent countries, about 70 of them. They all thought if they could just get rid of that external imperialist master, then they could promptly solve all their problems. But they had a lot of problems that they didn't quite realize. They had primitive agriculture, primitive or non-existent industry, primitive education. One of the countries in Africa had a total of 6 college graduates when it got its independence, seat in the United Nations. Same boat as Italy, Sweden. Dozens of other countries. They've got primitive health, and no country's agriculture industry can get much higher than the level of its health and its education. They have primitive transportation, primitive communication, and almost all of them suffered from the worst of the legacies of colonialism, which was this, a shortage of trained personnel. We wonder why they don't do things better in Vietnam, or why they don't do things better in some other countries. Anybody that got his head above the crowd generally got it knocked down by the colonial powers. Why can't the Vietnamese fight better? They didn't have any officer corps. The French were their officer corps. And the French didn't build up Vietnamese for civilian positions or military positions. They carried these things. You can't build up a military establishment overnight. It takes years to develop the habit of command, of decision, and the habit of automatic obedience, without which there's no effective military establishment. They weren't a military people. They didn't have a military tradition. Somebody else always made the decision. And this was true of all these countries. We demand that they have democracy. General Tew, get out of the way. Democracy. They never. We aren't doing too well ourselves. They never had any. They had a different way of getting their, of the choosing their leaders. What was theirs? Examination. For 2,000 years, they'd followed the old system that Confucius had really worked out, Mencius and the others. You can't get to high office in those countries unless you've demonstrated that you understand history and have passed the most rigid examination. They wanted their ablest people at the top. You don't have to pass any such examinations to get elected to high office in the United States. You don't have to have any qualifications whatsoever except get enough votes one way or the other. They thought their system was a better system of getting their ablest peoples into high positions than ours. Oh, no, they got to do it our way because we got all the answers. They have to be patient, put up with us. And they have to have our assistance or they can't make it. But down deep inside, they're not convinced. We give moral lectures rather than understanding, sympathy, and cooperative efforts to help them solve their problems. Gratifies us to issue orders. Of course, then we say we're not imperialists. This shortage of trained personnel. Actually, the strange thing is not how badly they've done. It's how well most of them have done with so little opportunity to prepare for independence. Now, while a billion people were coming to independence who weren't prepared for it, I'm not saying they shouldn't. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just asking that we understand their difficulty. Another billion people in the same time lost their independence. And these were not people without previous experience in self-government. These were some of the oldest and stablest and most competent peoples of history. Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, Czechs, Hungarians, Romanians, Bulgarians, Chinese, and so on. They've got longer periods of stability and competent management of their own affairs than we have yet demonstrated. And now they've lost their independence. No two such convulsions in all of human history have taken place as in the last 25 years. No wonder. There's anxiety, uncertainty. But these are the times in which we're meeting, and they confront us with dilemmas. If I were to ask you what you think America stands for at its best, I hope you'd respond with me that it's in one of those phrases in our Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, with liberty and justice for all. Now, that's what we really want, isn't it? But we better not talk too much about liberty and justice for all, because there's some people in Czechoslovakia might get that idea, or even some in the Soviet Union, or the folks who were trying to escape Red China. Oh, we must not talk about that. They might get trouble. We want to quiet things down. We want to hand the president over to work out adjustments, not with the people, but with the tyrants. So, do we really want liberty, or talk much at least about liberty and justice for all? These are just some of the tough dilemmas we face. If we take this position, it's bad. If we take that position, it's bad. What's a Christian going to think and do? Now, it's not my job, as Mr. Carr said, to tell you what to think. It is my job to say we must think as Christians, and or if we are Christians, we must think more deeply than we have, and with greater sensitivity and penetration into these problems which affect all the people of the world, as at no other time in history. There's another third of the world, approximately, the smallest third, and that's the developed countries, the older countries, mostly in Western Europe, that are still free, mostly in Western Europe and in the United, and in our side of the North Atlantic. Latin America, they're older countries, but they're not yet developed. They have some reasons which we won't go into, even if we know, haven't been able to find the way. Now America, in her own attitude toward the rest of the world, has gone through drastic swings of the pendulum. Up until Pearl Harbor, really almost a majority of the people still imagined we could do what we could do in the beginning, Washington's day, Jefferson's day. They didn't say no alliances, no entangling alliances. We always leave out one of their key words. No permanent alliance, Washington said, with any one group. We don't want to get tied up with permanent alliances where we're called upon to defend their policies, which we have no hand in formulating. They've got their own historic quarrels, boundary disputes, jealousies, enmities. We got two wide oceans here. We want to work out our internal problems. So in this case, it might be to our advantage to be allied with the French, but in the next one with the British, and the next one maybe with some other country. Don't get into permanent tie-ups. And this was a good policy. Enabled us to work things out. And there was, almost total isolationism here until World War II. Hitler was coming up to take Europe, and Japan's military had gotten control of that country and were out to take Asia. And then we swung from total isolationism to practically total internationalism. At the end of the war, these countries were prostrate. They were not going to make it. Greece couldn't make it. Italy couldn't make it. France couldn't make it. I was over in all those countries. They were finished. The Soviet Union had been given at Yalta and Tehran, Eastern Europe, and then divided Germany and gave her East Germany, and she could have gone right to the English Channel. Would have, unquestionably, if Mr. Truman hadn't said, we got an atomic weapon, and you ain't got it yet. And we had at that time the will, if necessary, to use it. And that held them back, that threat, while we could go over and give them not the training. These newly independent countries have got to learn the know-how. But the French had the know-how, the Germans had the know-how, the rest of them. It was a question of restoring their plant. Let them come back and get their fields into cultivation. They had been idle while the men were away fighting, or the battles had been fought over their field. Take in the case of Japan. She's an Asian country, but a developed country. And she was the unadulterated beneficiary of the war in Korea, because we had destroyed her old obsolescent plant, and then there was a war in Korea, and it was cheaper and faster to build industry in Japan to get stuff to our men in Korea than it was to go back to Minneapolis or Denver or Pittsburgh or San Francisco to do it. And so we rebuilt her plant, and her plant is more modern and more efficient than ours is, you see. Brand new. So as I say, we went over there partly in self-interest, partly in genuine outpouring of goodwill toward the rest of the world that all of history has nothing approaching. Over $150 billion taken from our own people. And while the money mostly wasn't spent over there, it was spent in our country to buy things. What they needed was not dollars. They needed what were produced in America that those dollars could buy. We spent the money here and sent them the products, better than 90% of it. Wasn't dollars, it was in American farm products and American industrial product. But we can't do it now, and besides, they're restored and productive. And the case of Germany and Japan, we disarmed them, and we've had to arm ourselves to protect them. Great, they don't have a military budget to mount anything. Wish we didn't. And could spend all our money for domestic purposes. See, we're so smart, and these things come back on us if we don't think about it. So they're a competitor which can undercut us now. And the president's right in saying there's got to be a realistic readjustment. But we've been feeding them for a long time, and who wants to get off the bottle? So The problem is not to go back to total isolationism. A lot of people are urging that. As if we could. After all, it was we who invented the steamboat. We destroyed the Atlantic and the Pacific. It was we who invented the airplane, not our enemies. It was we who developed missiles, not our enemies. We destroyed our physical separation from the rest of the world, put ourselves into the same boat, and imagine the rest of the boat can go down and we at our end won't go down. So the problem is how to come back from this exaggerated sort of total internationalism to a balanced, manageable internationalism. Not so much aid as to make them dependent, and not so little aid as to cause them despair, and they give up and go to the other side. Now, that's a pretty hard road to walk, isn't it? Total conflict, such as we've never faced before. But we're in total conflict in another sense. It's a conflict in that it involves all aspects of our life. It's a conflict, first of all, of arms. Whichever side gets arms superiority and has the wish to impose its will can do it. We had such superiority. And if we'd had one grain of imperialism in our national soul back 25 years ago, we would have said to the Soviet Union by telephone, open up your society. You cannot allow people to pour typhoid organisms in our water supply. You can't allow an outfit which announces it's going to take the world to be operating in secret on weapons that can destroy humanity. We'll open ours. You can see every weapon, every blueprint, every plan, every program, every machine we have. If you do the same, we offered it to them. But we didn't impose our will. We had certain restraints that came out, I think, of our exposure for a good many centuries to the spiritual values and ethical and moral restraints of the Judeo-Christian religion. Frequently you hear the youth nowadays say, well, the United States is militaristic, militaristic, militaristic. I don't know why somebody doesn't nail that down every time it comes out. It just simply can't be documented. We've been in four wars this century, World War I, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. We got into all of them belatedly, reluctantly, and quite unprepared. If we'd have been militaristic, we wouldn't have been prepared. When Japan went into Korea, into Pearl Harbor that day, she wasn't unprepared. When the Soviets walked into Czechoslovakia, she wasn't unprepared. One of the most unprepared. One of the most brilliantly planned and executed military operations in history. Every detail worked out in advance. That's militarism. The United States always comes home and takes its machines apart. A lady came up to me after church one day, my hometown church, home church in Washington, and she said, Dr. Judd, I've heard you talk about these things, but she said, you can't blame the Soviet Union for being apprehensive and so on. Look at all the missiles, and China, look at all the missiles, the bases we've built around them. And I could see how somebody planted in her mind, is in the minds of millions of Americans, the notion that the communists do what they do because they're afraid. They're hostile because we're afraid, rather than we have it armed because they were hostile, openly and avowedly. So I said, let me, just give me a couple of minutes here, will you, to try and go over the chronology here. At the end of World War II, we could have imposed our will, as I've just said. But what did we do? I said to the lady. We came home and we demobilized some 12 million of our armed forces, reduced our standing army to a little over 1 million. We put more than half our navy in mothballs. We grounded our air force until there were 2 years we did not have one squadron able to get into the air, combat ready. And we offered them the super weapon of which we had a monopoly on exactly the same terms as we have it ourselves. No country, victorious, powerful country in history ever did anything like this. And what happened? I asked her. It was then, when we didn't have anything for them to be afraid of, that they began their aggressive expansionism. It was then they put the pressure on Greece and Turkey. It was then they put on the first Berlin blockade, testing us. It was then they treacherously seized Czechoslovakia from within. It was then they started the wholly unprovoked aggression in Korea, just after we had taken every last American soldier out of Korea in order to get peace. So there wouldn't be anything for them to be afraid of. And that's when they started the aggression, and we had to go back. I said to the lady, and rebuild the armaments. I had to vote for them. Reluctantly, painfully, expensively, thousands of boys lost their lives because we weren't prepared. And I said to her, if the Soviet Union's afraid of our bases, and China, as you've been led to believe, they know how to get rid of them. Oh, so easily. Just let them come and say we're going to take down the Berlin Wall. If we build it, we can take it down. I won't start a war. Just let the people of Eastern Europe vote. If they're better off under communism, they'll vote for it. The West Germans vote. They manage their affairs pretty well. The East Germans are the same people. Let them vote. They don't let them vote. Have Gromyko come to the United Nations later this month and announce that we've given up our program of world domination. We had our big meeting in Moscow this summer, and we're now just going to work for the well-being of the Russian people, period. If they do that, there's no threat. I guarantee you that the Congress of the United States won't vote them your money to keep our armed establishment the way it is any longer than it takes to demobilize it. This charge that we're militaristic, we got plenty of faults, and I'll deal with some of them, but that won't go down. We're imperialistic, they say. Okay, we took the Philippines. If we'd been imperialistic, it would have been the first colony in a great empire. Instead, we took care of them as best we could, and then we said, what do you want? Do you want independence? Do you want commonwealth status? You decide. They wanted commonwealth. Gave it to them. After the war, they wanted independence. Gave it to them. We took Cuba. What did we do with Cuba? Make it the beginning of empire? No, we gave it its independence. We took Puerto Rico. We said to Puerto Rico, what do you want? You want to be a state? Okay, we'll take you as a state. You want to be a commonwealth? You want to be independent? You vote. They voted for commonwealth status. Many advantages. They don't have to pay income taxes and so on. They get all the advantages of the trade down there. But they decided it, not we. Now, it's just incredible the looseness and carelessness with which these slogans or labels are thrown around. We had the power in arms, but we didn't use it. If the communists get superiority, they will. Just as we've proved by some of the things I've recited that we wouldn't and didn't, they have proved that they will. They proved it in Hungary. They proved it in Cuba. And if we hadn't stood up in the confrontation finally at the last moment, it would have gone even more than it has. They proved it in Czechoslovakia. And after their 27 divisions had marched in and taken over Czechoslovakia 3 years ago last month, did they go back to Russia? Oh, no. They stayed there and they've developed the East European armies. They have 99 or 100 satellite divisions, that is Polish, East Germans, Czechs, Romanian, Bulgarian, Hungarian, and so on. And last fall, a year ago, this month, and October, they increased the Russian divisions on the border of West Germany from 27 to 32. And they had last fall, a year ago just now, the most massive land maneuvers ever held in history on the borders of West Germany. Our papers didn't play it up much. No, no, we mustn't, not even report the facts, let alone tell us, what's that about? Well, of course. They couldn't get it when Truman stood up at the Berlin blockade and Ike later and Kennedy later. But now, what are the Germans going to do? We told the Germans that they must never have anything to do with their own inventions. It was they who developed the buzz bombs, B-1 and B-2, the missiles which we have perfected. And we've said to them, you can't have it. And it was they who made the basic discoveries that led to the atomic weapons, not American scientists, European scientists, mostly German and Austrian. We've said to them, you Germans must agree never to have anything to do with your own inventions. You just must sit there essentially naked and trust us to use your inventions to defend you if those German divisions walk into you tonight as they walked one night into Czechoslovakia. But if we don't keep our word in Vietnam and so on, can the Germans trust us to keep our word to them? That's why Willy Brandt's going to Russia. Why should he trust the United States? I saw in the morning paper, Chicago Tribune coming through here, Japan perils to China plan. And the story is that yesterday Rogers and Fukuda, the foreign minister, held a press conference in which Rogers said that if Japan wouldn't join us in a resolution to admit Red China and preserve nationalist China's seat in the UN, that would greatly have a detrimental effect on the American effort. And the Japanese last week said it's absolutely essential to keep Taiwan in the UN, but it would not sign the other part of that to bring in Red China. I happen to know, as of this week, that our man up there, George Bush, has contacted 94 of the nations as of last week, and most of them agree with our position, not a one of them. Not one will co-sponsor the resolution. They don't have any confidence in the dependability of the pledged word of the United States. I was in Manila when the president announced he was going to Vietnam, going to Peking. Ike went to Korea, didn't he? So he's going to Peking. And the people were absolutely floored. And the Philippine president said, I think it was quoted here at home, he said, well, if the United States can do that to one ally, it can do it to other allies. So we've got to find other ways of planning for our defense. Now, you see, our problems haven't been imperialism. Our problems haven't been in militarism. Our problems, we haven't done our homework. We just sort of know we wish everybody goodwill. We have goodwill toward everybody, and we don't sit down and study everything that's involved. Stalin said, it is inconceivable that the Soviet Union can exist for an indefinite period side by side with Western imperialist states, meaning us. Khrushchev said, you know, we'll bury you. The red flag, he said, won't be raised by Russians, it'll be raised by Americans, those that have got Mao Zedong's and Viet Cong flags now. And Brezhnev, at their big celebration last year of Lenin's 100th anniversary of his birth, said, quote, revolution is the only road for world communism to achieve détente. Oh, no, victory. And Zhou Enlai, after the ping-pong business, he announced that they had adopted a two-America policy. He didn't call that. We've been talking about a two-Chinas policy. He issued the slogans that all the faithful around the world, including the Mao followers in this country, shouted on May Day, and one of them was, support the American people against the American government. Support the dissidents in every country around the world against the government, two Americas. They read about the protests, they see the demonstrations, they see the flags, they see the riots, they see the defectors. How can they trust the United States today? I didn't like this. I don't think it was necessary for us to be here. I didn't create it. I never yet liked to tell a patient I had discovered a malignantly spreading process. But if you find it, you have to report it. Times such as these. It's a conflict of arms. Maybe one reason the president's going to Peking is because he hasn't got the cards now. Truman had him. We had the superiority. Ike had him. Kennedy had him. Johnson had him. But there wasn't the will or the resolution to use them. But now they have. We had a monopoly, then we had superiority. Then Mr. McNamara said parity would give us greater security. And if we had superiority, that would force them to build, implying if we didn't, they wouldn't. We didn't, they did. And they've got superiority. Read the release about 2 weeks ago from the official Jane's, the British magazine that's accepted everywhere as the final. And it says, today, the Russians are ahead of us in everything except two. One, in naval arms now. One is in carriers. We still got 13 antiquated carriers. But they have developed, not with to shoot down planes and to take off planes, surface-to-air missile. And they have developed something like 45 destroyers with surface-to-surface missiles. And Jane says they follow our American carriers off around, and they surface-to-surface. We haven't got one. We got surface-to-air, but we haven't built one surface-to-surface. They can sink our carriers. At the end of war, they didn't have any navy except Coast Guard. And a year ago, April 17 months ago, they held the most massive sea maneuvers ever held. They had naval forces in the North Atlantic, the North Sea, the Mediterranean, right up almost to the Suez Canal, the South Atlantic, the Mediterranean, the North Atlantic, perhaps I missed that, the Indian Ocean, the South China Sea, and the North Japan Sea up to next to the Aleutians. The most massive sea maneuvers ever held in history, held in April and May of last year, and only 26 years ago they didn't have an ocean-going navy. What are they building these for? They've got all these SS-25s with 25 megaton power, and our biggest, of course, are our Minutemen, 1 megaton. They aren't building them against Israel. They aren't building them against Afghanistan. They aren't building them against Nigeria or Chile. What are they spending their money, taking it out of their people's mouths for these weapons? There's only one possible target. That's ourselves. Hitler was after Europe. Japan was after Asia. The Soviets and Red China, they're quarreling about how to do it, but not whether. They're after the world. And that brings to another item as to the kind of struggle this is. It's a conflict not only of arms, but of economic systems. Which will crack up first under this load? If we don't spend more and more for arms, we invite insecurity and disaster. If we do spend more and more for arms, as we have to if we're to keep ourselves safe, and at the same time more and more for everything we want here at home, we make sure increased or continued inflation and disaster. Either way, disaster. How would you vote? How would you vote if you're down there in the House and Senate? But it's also a conflict of wills. Which has the stronger and the steadier nerves? We had the power, we didn't have the will. They had the will, they didn't have the power. All these years, which will get first the will and the power? Japan was stupid enough to attack Pearl Harbor, galvanized us into action. They're not that stupid. They take it piece by piece. Thrust and then pause. And grab another one and then let's talk. Let's have some more conversations. And then thrust again and pause. Over and over again. Every time they pause, we say they're mellowing. They never, but we say they're mellowing. But it's deeper, gentlemen, than any of these. It's a conflict, most of all, between two totally different philosophies of life, two totally different sets of values, two different ways of doing things, two different approaches to life and its problems, two different concepts as to the nature of things, the nature of this universe. Is it a universe or is it a multiverse? Which means the nature of man. What kind of an animal is man? Just like the other animals? A little larger mind, period, nothing more? This means, of course, it's a conflict between two concepts as to the nature of God, or whether God is. It's most of all a conflict of faiths. That's why, and you can't just study the faith off of here in the vacuum, apart from the times in which it's to be lived. Our society was founded by men who wrote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident." We can't prove them. But they're so clear to us, this is our certainty, that we gamble the whole venture on them. What's the first one? That all men are created. There's a creator. That's the first one. And the second one, skip the second one. The third is, man is endowed by his creator, not by his government. He's endowed by his creator with certain unalienable rights. He's built this way. In the end, he cannot live without certain things. And among these unalienable rights with which he's endowed by his creator are life. You must have governments that can't deprive him of his life without due process of law. And his liberty to choose this, that, or the other thing, as we talked a little bit about in the beginning. And his opportunity to pursue happiness. Not happiness. Every once in a while I'd get a letter saying, they usually said, "The Constitution guarantees me happiness. I haven't got it. You get it for me." You know. No. It's a little blunt, not quite that blunt, but that's what it meant. Nobody can give anybody else happiness but All you could do is try to give him opportunity to pursue happiness. And one will make wise decisions and get it. Another make unwise decisions. That's the price of freedom. To say yes or no under the same circumstances. And there are casualties. But the price of freedom is that as long as it isn't immediately interfering with others' rights to make the same, to make their own independent choices, this is what the government is there for, to protect those freedoms. That is, they believed there was something in man different from anything any animal has. Different in character, kind, quality. And this is the unique thing. This is the precious thing. He's made in the image and likeness of God, which means, so we believe, he has something of God in him. As your boy's got something of you in him. And it's that which makes it possible for that boy to become more and more like you, if he's willing to respond to your loving quest of him, or to go against it if he wishes. He's not a product of conditioning wholly. He can say yes or no. So man has got something of God in him, and he has the capacity to make moral judgments and to make independent decisions, yes or no, on the basis of those judgments, regardless of his conditioning. And you see that happening all the time. This is the root of our society, at its best, I think. The communists deny all this, of course. They deny there's a creator. They deny that there is a moral order, that there are any such things as right and wrong, truth and falsehood, good and evil. Truth is what serves the revolution. Falsehood is what doesn't serve the revolution. Good and evil. There aren't any such things. They deny that man is anything other than that animal that has the largest and smartest brain in relation to the rest of his carcass. And they say, you and I believe that man has this capacity to make moral judgments. Animals don't. The beaver makes his dam today just exactly the way the first beaver did. But man doesn't make his dams the way the first man did. The dog comes in and lies around twice, the way his ancestors did. He's a prisoner of instinct. Man is not. He's the one animal that can step out of instinct and be sublime. Or be cruel, evil, sadistic like Hitler, as no animal is. Kills for food or fear. This is the potential to be godlike or to be satanic. They say that you and I believe this because we've been taught it. By rabbis and priests and ministers and writers of declarations of independence. And they'll explain it to you. I was under them for a long time, went through this again and again. They'll tell you this is why they must conquer the world. It's a mission, that's what they call it. To liberate us, that's their word, from these errors which have been passed down in our religion. They're not out, let's be clear on this, like Alexander the Great or Caesar or Napoleon trying to seize land or loot. Or gold, or wives, or slaves, or cattle on a thousand hills. This isn't a struggle about things or territory. It's about man, the nature of man, control of the mind of man, the soul of man, the whole of man. Therefore, they must conquer the world to make it impossible for fathers and mothers to pass on these old-fashioned ideas to their children, or to have religious institutions that could get people to read the Bible, which would undermine their doctrine. They don't have poison around. They're rational. They're logical. Not conditioned by these restraints. They must conquer the world in order to get out of man's thinking the idea that an individual should be responsible or can make decisions. He must think in terms of the masses. The individual doesn't count. And then you'll have peace, you see. Ah, they explain it to you. The idea that a man can own property and earn and own and sell and finance his own kids' education and buy a home and get a little better living for himself and his family makes people greedy, they say. I try to get more for me and my family. I clash with you who are trying to get more for you and your family. Wars. We want peace, don't we? They must abolish private property. Proletariat means those without private property. Marx said you can put the essence of Marxism in one sentence, the abolition of private property. And then bring up people to think in terms of the masses. Nobody tries to get more. No clashes. Peace. Don't you see? Whitaker Chambers said every dedicated communist he'd ever known, including himself, had joined up because of this promise of peace. Communism, I said once to one of these fellows giving it to me, a Chinese, I said, well, it sounds convincing. I had to be careful. I didn't want to get executed, but I just have a feeling somehow it won't work because of human nature. His eyes blazed. He said, human nature, you capitalists always talk about human nature. There is no such thing as human nature. Human nature is what you make it. Capitalism makes it selfish, wars. Communism will make it selfless, peace. See? Neat, 1, 2, 3, 4. Don't have to agonize. That's why it appeals to the intellectuals. There it is. Automatic. Wind it up. Go. Now, if this is what they believe, and they proclaim proudly this is what they believe, no one needs to be surprised at their behavior or denounce them for the things they do, the cruelties. Recent document, careful study that Mao Zedong and his people have executed at the lowest estimate, 34 million, the highest about 65 million. Moscow broadcast on its radio, they had executed 70 million, but they're a little prejudiced right now. They're logical atheists. I had malaria out in China, as you said, over and over. It never bothered me to spray DDT on troublesome mosquitoes. I killed them. They were animals. They were animals that were spreading a loathsome disease. Well, if there is no God, then man is not his child, and there isn't anything unique in that sense. And he's not more precious than mosquitoes. And why should anybody be surprised or lecture them for eliminating one man or a million men? They're not more valuable than mosquitoes. If there is no God, gentlemen, there is no accountability. We denounce people for denying human values? No, these are not human values. These are Judeo-Christian values. We've been exposed to them so long. We think we do these because we're human beings. And it's outrageous. And we call so-and-so, how could he do such an inhuman thing? He didn't do an inhuman thing. He did a merely human thing. Human beings unregenerated by a morally and spiritually regenerating religion tend to be predatory like other animals. Now, you ever heard Dr. Charles Mollick? Get him sometime for one of your seminars. He's the great Christian of Lebanese ancestry, was head of the UN General Assembly. I got to know him very well when I served up there. He said one day, you know, at the conference on human rights held in Paris right after World War II, I was the delegate of this newly independent Lebanon out from under a French protectorate. Mrs. Roosevelt, he said, was the head of your delegation. He said we spent 3 months trying, and in vain, to get agreement on what a human being is. Never did. How do you determine and declare the rights to which every human being by nature is entitled until you decide what a human being's nature is? One said he's the smartest of the animals. The other said he's a child of God. Gentlemen, this war is about the basics. This struggle, whatever form, is about the nature of things. Now, perhaps one reason for our confusion regarding this is because we've grown fuzzy regarding ourselves and our heritage here at home, and I'll try to discuss that tonight. At this point, I want to go on and deal a little bit with a more concrete study of how to deal with these conflicts. I don't think there's any question today of greater concern to more Americans than how in the world can you get peace? We want peace, and we haven't got it. Well, obviously, we haven't been doing it the right way. Jeremiah, 2,500 years ago, said, the people say peace, peace, and there is no peace. All during these centuries, people have wanted peace. And they've passed resolutions for peace. And they've renounced war, and they've denounced war, and they've paraded for peace. And they have yearned for peace, for peace, and they've hoped for peace, and they've prayed for peace, and there is no peace. It seems perfectly clear that we haven't been going about it the right way. There must be something wrong in what we've been doing. We've been peace wishers, and peace dreamers, and peace lovers. We're peaceful, most of us, and we're peaceable, most of us. Some of us are pacifists. Under no circumstances will we kill. More of us are passivists, P-A-S-S-I-V-I-S-T. We just don't do anything. But Jesus said, blessed are the peacemakers. Now, if he had meant the peace wishers and the peace prayers and the peace lovers and the peaceful, I have a notion he'd have said so. But he didn't. He said, blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called the children of God. You remember in the Beatitudes, only two mention of God. The pure in heart, he said. Blessed are they, because they shall see God. But oh, much deeper. Blessed are the peacemakers. They shall be called the children of God. They are the ones who are closer to the essence of God and his kingdom. And are working to help God bring it into being. Not just praying, thy kingdom come, but helping bring it into being on earth. Well, some people say, but didn't the angels promise peace on earth, goodwill toward men? No, they did not. Again, we don't study. The angels said, glory to God in the highest. When he's supreme, then the rest of it is, there will be peace on earth, goodwill toward men. We ignore the condition, just the result. Then we wonder why we haven't got it after 2,500 years. Glory to God in the highest. When men make God supreme, then there can be peace on earth and goodwill among men. Now, I must point out at this point that the question is not how get peace. Peace is easy to get. All you have to do is give in. Peace is easy to get. But what kind of peace? Mr. Chamberlain went to Munich to get peace in our time. He said all we had to sacrifice was Czechoslovakia, and his words, a distant country about which nobody knows much. But it wasn't Czechoslovakia alone that was at stake. It was England that was at stake. He got peace for a year, but it didn't make peace thereby. The Czech people got peace. They had to give in. What could they do against the giant? But is it endurable? I read last Christmas about a tour of 96 Czechs who got permission to go to Sweden over the Christmas holidays on a tour. 75 of them deserted. They're what you might call peace escapers. Peace of the prison. Peace is easy to get. But Jesus said, pay peacemakers. Now, I think you must also note this obvious but so often overlooked fact that it takes two to make peace. One cannot get peace by itself except on a basis of giving in. Is that endurable in the end? The peacemakers takes two to make peace. One can make war. And you can't get peace in the long run unless both sides want peace more than either of them wants something else. For example, conquest. Or freedom. Maybe you want freedom more than you want peace. Or maybe you want conquest more than you want peace. And you can't get peace unless both of them want peace more than either of them wants something else. Now, England wanted peace. She took insults from Hitler that the British had never taken from anybody else in centuries, but that didn't give her peace. The Chinese wanted peace. I was there when they wanted a chance to do what our forefathers did, to have peace so they could take care of solving all these problems and getting better education and health and highways and better living standards, agriculture and industry for their country. They were trying their best. Chiang Kai-shek, the last time I saw him, he said, haven't done a thing in Taiwan, which is the best job been done in the world. First country out of 80-some of these primitive countries we've been helping that did so well, we could stop our aid program there 6 years ago, July 1st. First one. Second was Israel. And it was not made up of untrained people, by and large. They came from Western Europe. Most of them are still, as I said earlier, on the bottle. But he said, we didn't do a thing in Taiwan that we didn't try to do on the mainland. But every time we got something going on the mainland, the communists came in and broke it up. Same as the Viet Cong do in Vietnam. They don't want the government to succeed. Of course not. Same as happens in many other countries. Try to break it up if you can. Their purpose is conquest, not resolution of the problems. So China wanted peace at the time Japan's military was marching. And Chiang Kai-shek had studied 2 years in a military academy in Japan. So he understood the Japanese language, could still speak it some. He made a broadcast to Japan in the summer of 1937, after the Japanese had started their aggression. The reason they started aggression against China was not because Jiang was doing so badly, but because he was doing so well. They didn't dare let it go on there. He was getting so much improvement there that the little stronger, the Japanese wouldn't be able to do it. So they started, and Jiang made a broadcast in which he said in substance this: "We Japanese and Chinese people live here side by side. We belong to the same race. We have the same written language. Our interests are not in conflict. For example, we're poor people," he said. "We have to buy cheap goods, and you make cheap things. You're our nearest neighbor. You could have almost a monopoly of the markets in China if your military will just give up its determination, apparent determination, to impose its political will upon us. We cannot give up our freedom. Please give up that. We want peace so we can develop these relations." Wasn't enough for them to want peace. The Japanese wanted something else. America wanted peace. We want it in Vietnam now. I could give you a dozen illustrations of the things the Chinese did after the war. 4 times in 1946, they accepted our pressure, a ceasefire. 4 times they had the communists surrounded, and if we just left them alone, they would learn it. But we forced them to have a ceasefire because they mustn't have an internal civil war. We couldn't put any pressure on the communists. We just pressure on our own friends. They had to give in and allowed the communists during those ceasefires to get up into Manchuria, where the Russians rearmed them, retrained them, and gave them at one stroke all the supplies the Japanese had piled up there, plus 600 American shiploads of munitions which had gone out of big Portland and Seattle and Vancouver across the Atlantic right through the Japanese islands. They never interfered with one of them because they had a non-aggression pact with Russia, and they had all they could do with China and America. They weren't ready to take on Russia yet. 600 shiploads were turned over to supposedly for Russia against Hitler, and she turned them over to the Japanese. More to the communists at one stroke than we gave Chiang Kai-shek from the beginning until today. You never hear much about that. These are the facts, of course. And the peace forces say we must have peace. Up on the steps of the Capitol, they read the names of all the Americans who've been killed in Vietnam, the peace forces. They never say a word about those who killed them. They have no responsibility for the war in Vietnam, those who did the killing on the other side. Going to get peace by just having forces, the forces of peace or the will to peace on one side? Mustn't we somehow get those to bear on both sides so both want peace? It's clear that so often the peace forces, I don't question anybody's sincerity, but it's clear they have followed policies that produced the opposite effect of what they had in mind. Maybe I could take just a word on a personal element here because of you, Carl, spoke of it. This is how I got into public life. The last thing on earth I ever expected to do was public life. I spent 19 years as a student and practitioner of medicine, and this is my profession. I was reasonably good at it, and I loved it. I didn't like being in politics anymore, and I liked being in the army in World War I. I didn't like it, but it was my duty, and I did it. How did I get into that? Well, I was out there in Japan, in China, when the Japanese began to bomb the Chinese. And I spent my days and nights taking American scrap iron out of the bodies of men, women, and children. I carried around for a long time, 2 or 3 years, so lest I forget a little piece that I had on identification, Erie, Pennsylvania. I took out of a Chinese leg I had to amputate because he'd been wounded 18 days earlier, a captain, and it was all a bag of pus time he got back to our hospital at the rear. They weren't prepared for war. They weren't trying to have war. They didn't even have a medical corps. And the bombs were dropped from planes flown with American gasoline. I couldn't sleep nights. Did the American people know what they were doing? You can't carry on a war without oil and iron, and Japan didn't have either. And where did she get them? She got them from the United States. Why did she get them elsewhere? Because there wasn't any place else she could sell her goods. She didn't have any gold. She didn't have any credit reserve. Her credit was no good, really. She had to sell her goods to get the foreign exchange to buy her goods. And who bought her goods? American church women. American women, largely. Not all church women. Sometimes I think if nylon had been invented 10 years earlier, wouldn't have had World War II with Japan. I came home and I said to the ladies, every time you buy a pair of silk stockings, you're giving the Japanese foreign exchange, which it buys four more machine gun bullets, which it sends, shoots into the Chinese. And then you good dear ladies go to the church and hold a bazaar or hot stoves in the basement to raise money to send me and other missionaries out to take the bullets out.